give your attention to Elder Allen Mansager. He's coming forth. He's going to give us the main message.
Greetings and blessings, everyone. And certainly our week has been blessed. And Randy and Jenny now are parents, and we have our first granddaughter. It certainly is a wonderful thing to have a family like that, and one that's blessed of Yahweh. We're thankful for the prayers and the answers that he had given us. And so now our lives are filled with hope, you could say, I guess. And will be for a long time. The message that I feel led to give centers on 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and the great falling away. When we look out at the religious landscape today, in the Western world, we see a pervasive drought. In all directions, it seems, that we look. There's a famine of the word, as the Bible has prophesied. Once rather lush, rich greenery is now nothing but shriveled up stubble. It's a dust bowl. Little grows there. The standards Yahweh taught in his word have for about half a century been systematically emasculated and eliminated, crumpled up like so much scrap thrown on the trash heap. Not even a semblance of the word, it seems, is being taught today. Itching ears. Don't want the meat of the word, but anything but the meat. Those who warm the pews and pay the bills dictate the agenda. And the people don't want to hear strong messages, no nonsense messages about changing their lives and walking on a higher ground. Just like the residents of Sodom, they become comfortable in their world. And the evil surroundings now only want to hear ear-tickling, silly little stories from the pulpit that make them feel good and content rather than the strong meat of the word that convicts them to change from their sin. They consume this psychological pablum that spins them completely off in another direction from what the Bible has taught us to go by telling them that they can be something greater than they are, they can reach their full human potential on their own. That they can have the life that was meant for them if they just reach out for it. It's kind of a self-serving message that replaces Yahweh and puts self back at the center. And now we've gone a complete circle all the way back to Genesis 3, where man comes before his worship of Yahweh. Jeremiah 5 describes it perfectly, I believe, describes our day. Jeremiah 5, verse 30, an appalling, and I'm going to read this out of the Revised Standard, an appalling and horrible thing has happened in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests rule at their direction. My people love to have it so, but what will you do when the end comes? That last phrase is rather sobering, I think. What will you do when the end comes and the truth is revealed? And your life is shown. This wholesale departure from the word by the entire world is focused on the latter days. Our day. No other time in history has experienced such an apostasy that we see today in our world. Such a grand scale. I can't think of any better confirmation of the truth of Yahweh's word than in seeing all the Olivet prophecies of Yahshua. All the Old Testament prophets, the book of Revelation, being fulfilled day after day after day, coming to pass exactly as it was foretold. Not one of those hundreds of prophecies has failed, brethren. Not one. Nostradamus, Gene Dixon, they got it right about 50% of the time, we're told. About as good as you and I could do. On the other hand, Yahweh's word is on target 100%. Not one thing in Yahweh's word has been disproved. 2 Thessalonians 2 says that in our day we'll see a great falling away. Some believe this applies only to the true worshipers, that small called out group of people who keep the commandments of Yahweh and have the faith in Yahshua, as we read in Revelation 12:17 and 14:12. But I don't think that can be. Because we also read, and Yahshua said, that this coming deception will deceive almost the very elect. So they're still standing firm. And for the elect's sake, the days will be shortened. So they're still there, holding true. Prophecy shows it to be a far broader context involving religion on a global scale. Let's read verse 1 of 2 Thessalonians 2. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Master Yahshua and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter, as from us, as that the day of Messiah is at hand. Don't be troubled when you see these things coming to pass. Yahshua spoke of Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. He says in verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means. Deception is such a common word in the context of the coming of Yahshua. We've got to be aware that there's going to be lots and lots of deception out there. People being pulled in opposite directions. But don't be deceived by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. And that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, the son of destruction, damnation. That's what perdition means. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called Elohim, or that is worshipped. All religion. He's going to exalt himself above any religion, biblical or otherwise. Hindu, Buddhist, doesn't matter. But especially biblical religion, because that is the true religion he has come to replace. So that he, as Elohim, sits in the temple of Elohim, showing himself that he is Elohim. And that's one of the reasons we believe that the temple will be restored in Jerusalem, because this man has to sit in that holy place. There's got to be a holy place there. So this is the first part of a very austere prophecy, one that tells us that there's going to be apostate faith on this earth, and don't be deceived when it happens. He'll be opposed to all worship related to Yahweh or professed to be of Yahweh. He will state that he is Yahweh himself and will force the world to give up all other worship on pain of death. All he needs is a little force to back up his teachings. Well, Revelation 13 says he'll have Satan behind him, along with a political sidekick working directly with him, and no doubt will have the nation's armies at his beck and call. This is far bigger than a falling away of a relatively small cluster of people, brethren. This is falling away on a grand scale. This individual will try to replace the Bible itself with his own teachings. He could come out and say, I am the true Messiah. The one you read in the New Testament was not the true one, I am. And then start calling down miracles from the sky, and people will just flock to him like a bunch of sheep because they don't know the word. They haven't been taught. If people were strong in the word, it'd be a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to pull something off like this. But if biblical worship is all but dead anyway, it's a pushover. It'd be simply a matter of getting the masses to switch worship to this soon coming super charismatic demoniac, especially when they have either fragile or no convictions of their own. Yahshua confirmed in Luke 18 that faith in the word would be almost non-existent. Why do we see what's happening today heading in this direction? Because we're seeing prophecy being fulfilled. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a gradual trend. Little by little, more of the Bible being thrown out. Little by little being replaced with entertainment, philosophy, psychology, anything but the Bible, anything to hold people firm to the word. Luke 18, verse 8, I tell you, that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Rhetorical question, but very meaningful and prophetic. Will he find it? This week, I read a couple of religious news reports that confirm that we're indeed moving in this direction of no faith on the earth and direct fulfillment of Bible prophecy. This is from Agape Press, off the internet. A Southern Baptist missionary stationed in Madrid, Spain, contends that Western Europe is currently the hardest mission field on earth. Chad, a 32-year-old Christian worker abroad, says the hostility to Christianity has become so severe in Europe that he's afraid to use his last name. When he approaches people, a typical response is, "Oh, we already know that. We don't need it." The region is marked, it says, by a spiritual deadness that you can't believe, he notes. To me, the hardest mission field on the planet right now. I think about Ephesians 6, where Paul talks about how we're fighting a spiritual battle, and the battle lines are drawn in Western Europe, especially with all the immigrants there. The American missionary believes Europe can be viewed as a sort of bellwether for the future cultural and spiritual scene in the U.S. Living in Europe, he says, I see Europe as probably 50 years ahead of where the U.S. is going spiritually. I don't think it's going to be that long. In Madrid, the Spanish equivalent to the House of Representatives just legalized same-sex marriages. What has transcended on Western Europe, he asserts, is just a spiritual darkness. He says most people see churches or cathedrals as just the buildings and nothing else. They are empty on Sunday morning. There's no spiritual sensitivity whatsoever. Brother Jim, who's not here today, but whose father is a Baptist minister, said over in where he went, I guess, was it England? Said they only have services now every other Sunday because they can't get anybody to come every Sunday. Well, that's the trend. People don't want anything to do with the Bible. Here's another report. This one is very sobering. A Texas pastor and a Tennessee minister of education are warning their fellow Southern Baptists about what they consider the toxic spiritual nature of public schools in America. The two men hope their proposed resolution to the denomination's resolution committee will cause Christian parents to seriously consider if government-run schools are the best place for their children. Skipping down here, it says, along with fellow Baptist David Scarborough, Arnold has submitted a resolution that calls on the denomination's churches to lovingly warn all of their members concerning the toxic spiritual nature of the government school system. He says the vast majority of Christian children, 88%, who attend public schools, leave the church once they graduate. Southern Baptists have been playing the ostrich with its head in the sand routine long enough, says. The Texas pastor laments the time is way overdue that we acknowledge the devastating effects public school is having on the faith of our children. He notes that while some in the Southern Baptist leadership maintain that sending their children to public schools is equivalent to being salt and light in a secular environment, data gathered by the denomination indicates just the opposite is happening. I just read where 6,000 schools in this country have classes on the sodomite lifestyle. 6,000, and I'm sure growing. A brother emailed me an editorial by a Christian missionary. This selection I thought was especially convicting. It says, I have truly been empowered by the Spirit to see the American church for what it has become. It is unacceptable. We must no longer allow this train to speed uncontrollably toward a bottomless pit of destruction. We must rise up and stand on the word of Yahweh. We must be willing to leave churches that do not abide by the truth of Yahweh's word. We must be willing to shake the dust off our feet and leave churches where there is evil and worldliness. I don't care if Grandpa started the church. If it is corrupt, get out. If it is led by worldly leaders, get out. If the pastor is quoting Hollywood movies, walk out in the middle of the sermon. Get out. Don't rationalize staying in a religious social club that only claims to be a church. If you are staying in a bad church just for friends, get out and get new friends. What are you thinking? If you go to one of these churches of today that makes you comfortable by feeding you and giving you all the worldly comforts of your living room at church, walk, get out. You are buying into a worldly church that only seeks to entertain you but not equip you. Walk. Sobering words. And we hate to see what's happening happen. But you know, brethren, Yahshua prophesied it all. He said it's all going to come to pass. Why do we see biblical faith in such a pathetic state of decay? The problem is Yahweh's word has been emasculated. It has no power or influence on people anymore. People just don't care. If they don't like it here, they walk down somewhere else to where what they believe, what they want to hear, is being spoken. Strong leaders taking strong action to confront sin wherever it rears its head are virtually non-existent today. The entire religious spectrum has bought into the politically correct idea of toleration, of acceptance of diverse views, even when those views are sinful, with a non-confrontational live-and-let-live philosophy, and it's about to eliminate all of what is left of biblical ethics. We can see it happening. We can see it coming. Well, I did some more reading. I put together a collage of letters I gleaned from a chat page that discusses what is happening in the modern church and the alarming lack of leadership and discipline therein. These are letters from churchgoers themselves, brethren, about the state of their own churches. And I think you might find it enlightening. The first letter. The 21st century Western Protestant church is highly individualistic, fractured, antagonistic to any sort of authority structures, and in large part anonymous. Most Americans are completely unwilling to make a long-term commitment to a local body of believers, much less subject themselves to the authority of that body. For the most part, churches know next to nothing about what goes on in the personal lives of their congregants, and their members like it that way. Under these conditions, it is virtually impossible for churches to really follow the commands of Messiah regarding church discipline. And even more unlikely, it would make any difference to an evil and adulterous generation. Someone wrote in response, "I realize that our churches have become more like social clubs. In the past, churches were refuges, places to find material and spiritual help, communities of like-minded people wanting to know Yahweh. There was a fear and reverence toward Yahweh. Now there is so much emphasis on entertainment and an attitude of, what can we do to get people in?" A third person writes, "Yep, therein lies one of the biggest issues in the modern church, no accountability. It's more like a live and let live, let bygones be bygones mentality. The organized church's credibility is seriously weakened because of this lack of accountability." Another one writes, "On the other hand, lack of discipline is a big problem in the modern church. But one of the best pastors we had at our last church confronted a member about her adulterous affair with a man who was not her husband. That pastor didn't last a year after that. The woman was the daughter of one of the deacons. Point to consider, that deacon today, 15 or so years later, is pretty much a mindless husk. On the other hand, though, I'm not sure that there are enough spiritually mature church leaders around to appropriately administer church discipline." Another letter. "I recognize that all within the church will still sin, but turning a blind eye to blatant irresponsibility is, well, irresponsible. As parents of adult children, you can pray and advise, then without enabling, try to help shattered lives. But there are legions of pastors who lack the moral courage to confront and deal with issues in their congregations that everybody already knows are problems." Here's a sad account. "My daughter at 20 married a much older man. We fought it tooth and nail. It lasted 7 years. He never kept a job. Had 9 jobs in the 7 years. And seemed to look to Yahweh, otherwise known as the church and anyone else, to make provision. It was disgusting. Within 3 years, she married again. We begged her not to. Yesterday, she confesses that her new husband was not actually divorced from his first wife at the time of their marriage, so it is not legal. And he shows no interest in redo. I guess he decided he'd rather be single again. Nevertheless, needless to say, she is devastated. We are in a coma. We're committed Christians, married for 36 years, and integrity is our standard. Not one pastor or deacon had the courage to confront those men, both Christians, one in leadership, or even suggest the possibility of personal discipline before the church. I am appalled by the failure of church leadership to address behavior that is so blatantly sinful that has repercussions on small children, the wife, extended family, and the reputation of the body. Are there no real men left in the pastorate? This person writes. There's more, but you get the idea. People can see it. There's problems everywhere, and it's all because the standards of the word have been neglected and dropped. The last 50 years has been a decline like who would have ever imagined. Hebrews 13:7 reminds leaders they must give account. Paul said he is innocent of the blood of all men because he declared the entire counsel of Yahweh. This person writes, and I'll end with this one. I think leaders and members alike need to be reminded of the duties and responsibilities of leadership before they seek and select their leaders. Too often today we're afraid of offending someone, and so the church tries to avoid things that ought to be confronted. All of this, I think, is setting the stage for what we read back in 2 Thessalonians 2, and I want to go back there. I want to look at verse 5. 2 Thessalonians 2, 5. Remember you not that when I was yet with you, I told you these things? And we can go back and look at prophecy and see, yes, Yahshua told us these things. Are we surprised? And now you know what withholds that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he now lets, who now lets, will let until be taken out of the way. The Greek has badly mangled this. I should say the Greek it doesn't. The translators of the Greek have. The Greek actually says this. There is one who holds fast until he appears out of the midst. He waits for his time, in other words, which harmonizes with the next verse. This Anamessiah is waiting. No doubt he's alive today and waiting for the right time. And then verse 8, and then shall that wicked be revealed, whom Yahweh shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. And that's really Yahshua, who's going to come and destroy this evil man. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. So Yahshua comes after all of Satan's deeds are done. And all those things we read about and all the persecution that's going to come to Yahweh's people. All of these things will happen first. But first there's going to be, as we read, the great falling away. Lying wonders, false impressions, thinking that they're following, but they're not following the truth. Notice now in verse 10, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. They didn't want the strong meat of the word. New Revised says, and every kind of wicked deception for those who are perishing, because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. It's not easy. The sword cuts, the double-edged sword cuts, and it hurts. But we have to change, brethren. We can't remain the same people we are. We have to follow Yahweh and change our lives. Keep verse 3 in mind here. Rebellion and turning away from the truth must come first, or none of this will happen. There must be a general falling away. The Bible must essentially be thrown out, as we see our government doing everywhere, so that there won't be any opposition to this man of sin. He can just walk in, everything's set up for him, and people just fall by the millions, by the billions. They'll fall for this man because there won't be anybody to say no, to say he's wrong, this isn't right, this isn't the truth. Yahweh's people are going to be running from pillar to post, taken out into the wilderness. There'll be the two witnesses prophesying in Jerusalem, and that'll be about it. Matching probably miracle for miracle with this man. Rebellion and turning away from the truth. There must be a general falling away. Yahweh's word must be ineffectual in the minds of millions, or it could never happen this way. They must have virtually given it up. And we see it coming. Like the immigration from Europe to America, we see the same thing, the trends coming. And it seems like when they make laws anymore, they look to Europe, they look to Canada to decide what American laws are going to be. How are they doing it? Instead of standing on the ethic that built this country, Yahweh's word. Well, the rest of this chapter is an encouragement to stand firm, stand firm, stand firm, Paul writes. Look at verse 15. Wherefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions. That's the precepts. It's number 3862 in Strong's. Those given in Yahweh's word, hold to them. You're going to need them. You're going to need strength, which have been taught, whether by work, I'm sorry, by word or our epistle. Doctrinal teachings able to refute the heresies that are going to cover this planet when that Antimessiah comes on the scene. And he's going to be so deceptive you won't believe it. It'll make your mind spin. You know, when I get a full dose of poison ivy, which I'm ready for it, my first dose this year, which I always get in the spring, I got to be careful about secondary infections because my immune system is compromised. You know, your body is busy dealing with this skin thing, and you've got to be careful about cutting yourself or something. I did that one time and was putting up insulation, got infected in my finger, and the surgeon said almost lost it because I was weak from that poison ivy. When a human body is strong in its immunity, it's not going to be subject to other outside attacks, to the everyday infections and so on. And you won't get sick easily. When a group of people is strong and united, they're going to stand firm. And it's hard to penetrate it with air. And that's what's the beautiful thing about the body of Messiah. People can help each other. You know, bounce it off somebody else and, oh no, I don't, that's not right. Look what the word says here. Oh, you're right. You know, I almost got off on that. When you're out there alone battling Satan, believe me, it's not easy. And you're subject to being thrown off course. The reverse is true, and that is the main reason why we see what we see in our world today in decline. What we see out there is a religion that's become weak, subject to infiltration. Let's turn to Galatians chapter 1. Paul battled heresies from the beginning of his ministry. It seemed like right off the bat, he had to fight. He had to fight for the truth because there were those that would take it away. Galatians 1 verse 6, I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Messiah unto another evangel, a different kind of evangel, which he says is not another, which is not a different kind. It's the same kind. But you see, it's brought in subtly. If you're going to have a counterfeit, you have to have it pretty close to the original, but with a lot of significant differences. And that's what he says we have to watch out for. But there be some that trouble you and would pervert the evangel of Messiah. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other evangel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. Word of Yahweh stands true. It could be an apostate angel for all we know. He says, don't listen. And as we have said before, so say now again, if any man preach any other evangel unto you than that you have received, let him be accursed. For do I now persuade men or Elohim? Or do I seek to please men? Please men. So many people are out there pleasing men to fill their pews. It's unbelievable. They've given up the word. For if I yet pleased men, I should not be the servant of Messiah. But I certify you, brethren, that the evangel which was preached of me is not after man. For I neither received it of men, neither was I taught it, but by the revelation of Yahshua the Messiah. There we can prove, show. You know, some people are throwing out the writings of Paul. He says he received it directly from Yahshua. How can we question that? Yahweh's people must maintain a solidarity. The danger comes, brethren, with compromising, becoming the Pergamos assembly that declines into the dead Sardis assembly. Have you ever noticed that? The seven assemblies in Revelation? Let's turn there. It is fascinating. It's something I just discovered this morning in getting this message ready. The order of the seven assemblies in Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3 is the typical progression that we see today, I should say, retrogression, from truth to apostasy that we see happening spiritually today. Look at it. First of all, you have the Ephesus Assembly, a name that means desirable one. The Ephesus Assembly. What happens to them? They leave their first love. They leave their foundation. They leave their love of the truth. The desirable one now starts to slip. When your zeal wanes, you begin to be subject to attack, don't you? When you get lackadaisical, well, I don't know. I should go to assembly today or not. I don't know if I want to study today. I'm just getting kind of discouraged. Evil one snatches right up on that. He picks up on that like you wouldn't believe. And he's ready to infiltrate. And that's what happens. Ephesus, they lose their first love. They become less zealous. And that brings us to the next one, Smyrna. I'm sorry, Thyatira. Not Smyrna. Thyatira becomes the embattled one. So as soon as we lose our zeal, we subject ourselves to attack. Verse 8, the angel of the assembly in Smyrna write, "These things says the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know your works and tribulation, poverty, though you're rich," rich in the word. "And I know the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews, Yahudim, those who praise Yahweh," that's what the Hebrew says, and we do have a Hebrew revelation, "and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of these things which you shall suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, I will give you a crown of life." So we go from Ephesus, that lost their first love, to the embattled Smyrna, an assembly under siege. What happens when we come under siege? Usually, if we're weak, we compromise, don't we? Compromise. And that's Pergamos. The angel of the assembly in Pergamos write, "These things says he which has the sharp sword with two edges. I know your works and where you dwell, even where Satan's seat is, and you hold fast my name and has not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you, because you have those there that hold the doctrine of Balaam, and who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, and to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication. So have you also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I will come unto you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of the mouth, of my mouth. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says in the assemblies." So we have compromise of Pergamos. We often compromise to make the enemy go away. The Pergamos assembly is marked by acceptance of various heresies, doctrines of Balaam and Nicolaitans, we read. What's next? What comes after that? Which comes after compromise? The next one is Thyatira, verse 18. "Unto the angel of the assembly in Thyatira write, These things says the Son of Elohim, who has his eyes like unto the flame of fire, and his feet are like fine brass. I know your works, and charity, and service, and faith, and patience, and your works, and the last be more than the first." These sound like pretty good, strong believers. "But I have a few things against you, verse 20, because you suffer that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols. You open your doors to apostasy, to another teaching, and pretty soon it's going to infiltrate. That's almost sure that's going to happen. Rarely does it go the other way around. So now, we have the assembly that compromised now down to an assembly that tolerates sin. And once you compromise doctrine, sin lies at the door. Believe me. I can show example after example after example. Sin kills. And that's just what we see in the next assembly, the Sardis assembly. The Sardis assembly. And that we find in chapter 3, verse 1, unto the angel of the assembly in Sardis write, these things says he that has the seven spirits of Elohim and the seven stars. And I know your works, that you have a name, that you live and are dead. It's dead. He says, I know your works. You have a name, but you're dead. Nothing going on. You're a dead assembly. Not growing, not teaching, not convicting, nothing. You're dead. And that's exactly what sin will do. It'll kill a body of believers. He says, be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before Elohim. Skip down to verse 5. He that overcomes, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. Very serious thing to have your name blotted out of the book of life, because that's pretty much it for you. That's curtains. And they're dead. Now, we come to an anomaly. Verse 7. All of a sudden, we have the Philadelphia Assembly. Hooray! We all know about them. They're the good folks. They wear the white hats, you know, and all that. These things says he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David, he that openeth and has, and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. I know your works. Notice works. Behold, I have set before you an open door. No man can shut it. For you have a little strength. Not strong, not big, not massive, just a little strength. But you've kept my word, and you've not denied my name. Behold, I'll make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. This assembly holds true. They don't lie. They live their faith. They live their faith. It's pure and true and upholds Yahweh. They're small. They don't compromise. They don't compromise for number's sake. They don't compromise for wealth. They have little strength, but they keep his word. They don't deny his name. They're faithful to the end. So right in the middle of this gradual decline, spiritual decline through these assemblies, we have some hope, the Philadelphia Assembly. Finally, what's the last one? Verse 14. Unto the angel of the assembly of the Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of Elohim. And of course, this is all Yahshua speaking. I know your works. And this is as sad as it gets. I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot. I wish you were cold or hot. It'd be an easier decision if you were, but you're lukewarm. And so, because you are lukewarm, and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth. These people are rejected. This is the Laodicean assembly, and Yahweh spits them out of his mouth in very dramatic language. They're worthless. If you're lukewarm, he's saying you're worthless. You either get in the game or get out of the game, but don't have one foot in and out, because you can't do anything. You might as well not even be there. You're lukewarm. You know, you stand for something, then you don't. You teach something, then you back off. He says, you're no direct. You can't give guidance to anybody. You don't have any firm direction. You're worthless. Why? Verse 17, because you say, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. And they have need of everything. And know not that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked, of course, spiritually speaking. But you see what riches do? They kill the spirit of Yahweh. Because you start counting on riches and you start ignoring Yahweh. You know, when you're under duress, when you're under tribulation and trial, you get right with Yahweh real fast, don't you? You approach him in prayer constantly. You feel close to him because you need him. When you have no need of him, because you're rich and fat and happy, you lose him. You push him out of your mind. And that's when you open yourself up. He says, I counsel you to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that you may be rich. Gold tried through tribulation, trial, hard times. Hard times. That you may be clothed, and that the shame of your nakedness do not appear, and anoint your eyes with eye salve. You know, not having a lot of wealth seems to be the characteristic of Yahweh's people. Why is that? I was talking to a brother last night. He had a business, and he said, the wealthy ones often stuck me. I'd build them something, and might be a doctor, a surgeon, might be a lawyer, somewhere in the big city. Wouldn't pay his bill. You'd think, you know, people that could easily afford it would certainly be the first to do so. But he said the person who's struggling, the one who just makes an average income, he said no matter if they couldn't pay it or not at the time, they would make arrangements with me, $25 a week, to pay the bill. I found the same thing. We get letters from people who call themselves doctor. They never do anything to help us. Not once. In some 30 years, I've never seen a doctor, someone who's, you know, supposedly well off, ever do much of anything to help the brethren. And that's why I think one of the things Yahshua said was, it's harder, for a rich man to enter the kingdom. Because they're pulled in all sorts of other directions. They don't have their eye focused. They haven't been tried through the fire. They haven't been kept close to Yahweh because of the trials they're undergoing. That's just human nature. And it's sad. But look at the ones Yahshua called. Tent makers, fishermen, tax collector. He wasn't very popular either. But these people had true hearts because they struggled. They knew what life was all about. They weren't living on some cloud nine somewhere and not in touch with the average man. They struggled, and they knew what it was to suffer, and they knew what it was to stay close to Yahweh. Laodicean assembly is worthless. They're rich, they're fat, they're happy. They're just a club. They're just a gathering. They're just a social thing. They're not doing any work. They have no work to do. All of this shows a progression from bad assemblies all the way to the good assembly, the Philadelphia assembly that's tried and true. And we see it as it starts to decline, and it starts with the first assembly, that the Ephesus assembly that lost their first love, and it just was downhill from there. It's important that we stay strong in Yahweh's word. Don't lose that first love that we had. We are called into the truth. So many people, you know, they're on fire. Wow! And we get this question, and I guess it's because they've never heard these things before. They say, what kind of Bible do you have? What version are you reading? I'm just reading the same book you have in your closet. You know, it's covered with dust, I guess, or whatever. Take it out and read it. Look at it. I'm just reading it like it is, putting the pieces together as they were given to us through the covenant, then the second covenant. Put it together. But it's so amazing, and people get on fire when they hear the word. And then they, after a while, well, you know, it gets become kind of common, and they get kind of locked into a pattern, and pretty soon they start to drift. They can't stay strong. And that's what we see here. An assembly that lost its first love is destined to end up lukewarm and worthless. This is the progression that I see in motion right now out in the spiritual world. A progression of those that have lost the first love and now are setting themselves up for deception. And the Antimessiah is going to come right along there, and he's going to say, this is a walk in the park. These people have no conviction. They're not a threat. They're going to offer no resistance. Kind of like Hitler going through France, I guess. You know, they tried, but they didn't offer much. This is the progression that's in motion right now. And it'll end up with the takeover of all religion by the Antimessiah, who ultimately will be cast out with the glorious return of Yahshua the Messiah, who will destroy him with the fierceness of his coming. I guess my message today, brethren, is stand fast. Don't be afraid of man or his devices. Don't be afraid what people say when you bring them the truth. Don't be afraid. Stand boldly for truth. Because one day we're really going to be tested. Are we going to stand boldly at the point of a bayonet, whether we're going to stand for Yahweh or become like some of these other assemblies that just compromised and say, it's too much. I just can't do it. The crown that each of us has been promised will be there for the faithful. And don't let any man take that crown. May Yahweh bless you.